Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson for Nature Now, in the middle of October. Storms came last week, bringing wind and rain and causing a dash for emergency supplies. Perhaps we are more prepared for winter than we were before the storms. Laurel Moulton joins us as a guest today to explain growing plants for the new Elwha land. But first, our mystery sound. This is not often seen, but there are enough of them around here that they make it onto birding lists. If you ever see one, you will never forget it. And now Charlie Fleischman will help us read some observations.
Puget Sound garter snake. Seen last week on a rare sunny afternoon, the Puget Sound garter snake appeared. Wendy Tweeten posted its photos on iNaturalist. This one lives in the Puget Trough, an ecoregion. This ecoregion embraces the lowlands and marine waters lying between the Cascades on the east and the coastal ranges here on the west. Garter snakes are difficult to tell apart. The identification came from other observers who posted. Puget Sound garter snake has distinct pale and darker blue stripes between its black stripes. It's mighty pretty.
We had, over the weekend, a hunter's moon, or what seems to be called lately a supermoon. It was pretty much hidden by clouds on Sunday night, but the supermoon did poke through on the 16th. It appears bigger because the moon's orbit brings it closer to Earth than usual. If you missed it because the weather hid the light, other supermoons are on the way. We'll see two more this year, November 14th and December 14th. Wait for the November moon in particular. NASA says it is not only the closest full moon in 2016, it's the nearest to Earth so far in this century. The next moon, as spectacular as November's, will not come along until 2034, and some of us may not be waiting for it.
Birds and wind. Even though the winds were fairly moderate, 30 to 40 miles per hour, a bit higher in gusts, wonder how birds manage storm winds. Taking shelter comes first. Inside hollows of trees, thick hedges, brush piles, the wind speed can be moderated. Microhabitats can help enormously with cold temperatures. Even though it can be bitterly cold at our nose level several feet above the ground, the temperature can be many degrees warmer just a few inches above the ground. This effect is magnified even further when the sun is shining. During a bitter, nasty day, try lying on the ground for a few minutes, especially behind something that breaks the wind. Some reports also say that birds can sense changes in air pressure and will forage for more food before going into shelter.
Speaking of the Elwha, salmon have been seen far upstream from former dam sites. For the first time in more than a century, salmon have reached stretches of the Elwha River upstream from two dams built in the early 1900s and obviously recently removed. In August 2016, the fisheries biologists observed live salmon and the high reaches. In September of 2016, USGS scientists doing topographic surveys found carcasses of Chinook salmon that died after migrating from the ocean to above the upper dam site, completing their natural life cycle. The farthest the fish have been seen upriver so far is at River Mile 29. That's a considerable ways above, said one commentator. Although the dam removal had concluded in 2014, a boulder jam remained a fish barrier until last fall when NPS dynamited the boulders. Fish return is a huge success for the Elwha River Restoration Project, and this project was recently honored as a finalist for the International River Prize. We are today talking with Laurel Moulton, who is the assistant manager and volunteer coordinator, both of those are big jobs, at the Matt Albright Native Plant Center. She also works with the Lower Elwha Klallam Tribe. And today we are going to talk primarily about the fascinating work that has gone on in helping to get the Elwha revegetated somewhat when about 700 acres of land were suddenly available. So, Laurel, would you just start in by telling us what brought you into being a plant producer of native plants, and then we can talk a little bit about the Elwha.
I've been interested in plants for my whole life. I started off my career in college in environmental studies and thought I would go towards rivers and fish, and then I just hopped into a plant job, and I realized that's what I really enjoyed doing, growing plants and kind of troubleshooting plants and restoring areas that have been impacted by humans. It was an easy choice for me.
Well, it's an easy choice, but it's a heck of a lot of work, and it's a good thing that your work has found you and you have found your work at this point. At this stage, the Matt Albright Native Plant Center is relatively new. Is it 4 years? I've forgotten.
It opened in the fall of 2009.
Okay, so that's a little more than 4 years, but I think of it always as being rather new. And what you have been doing, of the largest things you've been doing recently, is producing the plants to install out on all of that bare land in the Elwha. How have you gone about planning how many plants to decide and which ones you choose? And you've got a greenhouse there, and it needs to get full of things that are useful.
Yeah, so this greenhouse was built specifically for the Elwha River Restoration Project. We knew that we were going to need quite a few plants. It's over 700 acres that were exposed. But in some cases, when you're dealing with nature, you can't tell exactly what you're going to end up with. And so what we did, this was before my time, but they went out and collected seeds directly from the Elwha Valley and nearby and tried to focus on plants that were common recolonizers in disturbed riparian areas. They chose plants that could survive in hot, harsh environments because that's what the lake beds became after the water was gone. And then also we just tried to select a diversity of plants with the goal being to increase diversity to accelerate forest formation and minimize invasive weed incursion and repair ecosystem functions.
That's a lot of work right there in what you just said. So primarily you've started then with the seeds that had been gathered essentially from the areas, not from the area exposed, because that someone mentioned, I think it was you, that there was an early belief that it would be kind of a desert out there where the lakes had been. So you were gathering seeds or having them gathered around the edges of the area?
Yeah, our seed collection zone was all the way up to the 2,000-foot level within the Elwha River watershed. And then in the lowlands, we went about 5 miles on either side, so over to Salt Creek on the west and Peabody Creek on the east. We determined that the plants within that area would be genetically fine for putting on the Elwha. Oftentimes, more difficult, you could get red cedars from Alaska. You could get them from California, but they might not be quite evolved for this area.
A new idea? I mean, it seems to me that restoration keeps getting more and more precise, and that one of the most precise ideas is let's restore it with what is already genetically present. Is that something that's been going on for a long time?
Yeah, over time, the concept of seed transfer zones has been developed, and it kind of depends on what your restoration focuses on. I think early on, restoring forests and trees, people were looking for things that grew fast and were good for timber. Now we look for things that are locally adapted. So depending on the species, there can be different seed transfer zones, and many of them are tested in common garden experiments. So if you collect seeds from the same species from multiple different microclimates or areas and grow them right next to each other in a garden setting, that takes out the site effects on the seed, and the result plants grow, and the differences you see are their genetics rather than effects of the site. Seed transfer zones are developed using common garden experiments.
Seed transfer zone is a completely new term to me, partly because I'm not a restoration specialist. But does that mean the place at which the seed ceases to be genetically available for, say, the Elwha Valley, for the place that you're restoring?
A seed transfer zone, it just denotes an area where you can be relatively certain that the genetics of that zone are appropriate for any other place in that zone.
Okay.
I guess you would say. Because you can have the same species that grows in many states or, you know, many
sure.
different countries, but there's going to be little differences depending on the local area.
So that improves the chances of the plant surviving and thriving.
Yes.
Presumably.
yeah, that's exactly it.
Once a plant has been planted out, and I know a great deal of this is done with the help of volunteers, how have these plants survived over time? We've had two extremely dry summers, I think, and I'm just wondering if that has affected plants that have gone out. When you monitor, what do you run into about how they're doing?
There's a couple factors that go into it. When the lakes were emptied, the result was layers of sediment, and some of it is fine sediment, so clays and silt and clay, and then some is just gravel and cobble and sand. And you can imagine that plants are going to favor the fine sediments a little bit better. So it depends on what kind of sediment they ended up on. And then also it's just you get rid of all that water and there's nothing growing. So it's just rock and gravel and just baking in the heat.
Mm-hmm.
There's no protection from wind. And so the results have been variable. Early on in the project, the water table was still elevated because the lake used to be there. And over the years, the water table dropped. Yeah, so early on, we were having a high 90% survival rates. For some species, and as the water table has dropped, it's gotten a little bit lower, down to the 70s,
sure.
or even lower for different species. But last year, when we had such a hot, dry summer, we actually had better survival than in the previous summer that was much cooler. And
that is in the too many variables department, right? You can hardly tell why things are happening.
Yeah, I mean, that was really unexpected because last summer, as you remember, was an exceptionally hot and dry summer. But
mm-hmm.
we kind of hypothesized that it might be because as more plants grow and the ground is covered, the local climate has changed a little bit by having other vegetation and shade.
It's so cooler and its shade has been created.
Yeah, shade is created and moisture is kind of kept.
I think that you mentioned that over 200,000 plants had been put in. Is that possible?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, over 200,000 plants in both Lake Mills, which is the further south lake, and then Lake Aldwell, which is downstream. Each year, we've had between 30 and 70,000 plants have been put in. And many of those we grew here at the nursery, but we also collected seed and sent it out to other native plant nurseries who sent us bare root stock to augment what we could grow here.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it's the same genetic seed, but it's being grown in a different greenhouse?
Yeah.
And you mentioned also, because I was thinking about plant choices based on these challenges, that in some cases you can't just plant an elderberry. You have to choose a blue elderberry rather than a red one. I mean, are there a lot of sort of fine-tuning you need to do to the plants so you get the right ones?
Yeah, we tried to choose plants that, in some cases, that did better in open, dry areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the blue elderberry. Most people around here are more familiar with red elderberries that tend to like wet areas and shady areas. But as you move east to Squim and Port Townsend, you'll start seeing blue elderberry because they like open, hot, dry areas. And historically, there were blue elderberries in the Elwha, and there still are, but there's just very few of them because that the open, hot, dry habitat is kind of lessening as trees come in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so we tried to collect blue elderberries instead of red elderberries. We also collected Rocky Mountain maple, which most people don't even know that we have in this area. It's a type of maple that
I didn't
really well.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, really well in hot, dry areas. And there are a few of those in the Elwha Valley. Those seeds we collected in the Elwha, there's a few trees there, and there's some around Lake Crescent as well. For the blue elderberry, we actually ended up starting to collect seeds in Squim because the seeds that we collect in the Elwha Valley weren't as viable because there aren't that many plants around.
Which brings up the question of the active working time for what you've been doing. The seeds need to be collected in the end of summer and early fall. And then you work through the winter. I think you said there's a pattern to how you work.
Yeah, we start collecting seeds actually in June. Yeah, because we can collect things like salmon berries if we're going to grow those, and trailing blackberries come a little bit later. So the busiest seed collecting time is definitely August, September, but we start in June and we can go to October.
At this point, you're beginning to reach the end of the project as it was originally defined. Yes, this is this. You've planted a lot and things are coming up. How does it work now at this point? The lakes are beginning to be repopulated.
This winter is going to be our sixth planting season and the final planting season. We found last year, in addition to having trouble getting to the sites because of weather and flooding, we also found that every time we stuck a shovel in the ground, we were digging up seedlings to put in another plant. And so it just doesn't make sense to dig things up, dig one thing up to put in another. So things out there looking pretty good.
Okay. So
yeah, if people haven't been out there since the dams were removed, I really recommend that people go and take a look.
It's a wonderful place to walk. And the bridge is returning, yes?
The park anticipates that the Olympic Hot Springs Road to access Lake Mills will be open by the beginning of October. It could be sooner, but we're sticking to beginning of October.
Well, a lot of us are going to be very happy to get back there. So
<Yeah.
laughs> when this project then gets to a finishing spot, the greenhouse exists and you will continue to plant and tend for other projects?
Yes, there's ongoing projects in Olympic National Park. The visitation increases every year in the park, and with each extra foot that walks on the trail or each person
sure.
who camps in the high country, everything adds up to damage. So we're restarting the high country restoration program, starting with Flapjack Lakes. We're also doing work on the Spruce Railroad Trail. So we've been salvaging ferns there this past week to get them out of the way of the widening efforts. And we're doing other work along Highway 101.
And all of this is the area where you'll work is being selected with the guidance of the Olympic National Park staff. I mean, they're saying, hey, we need you up in this area. Flapjack Lake is losing its plants. Or mostly people make trails across where they shouldn't. That's one thing, isn't it?
There's just so many people out there. It all causes some type of impact. And so we get the work through, you know, things like the Olympic Discovery Trail being put on the Spruce Railroad Trail. We mm-hmm. know that causes a lot of damage, so we help with that. Or there's going to be significant projects happening on Highway 101 around Lake Crescent. So those things, they come to us and ask us to produce things for that. But we have somebody named Ruth Scott who is in charge of all the wilderness programs in the park, and she historically has had a backcountry restoration program to rehabilitate campsites that have gotten out of control all the way from the subalpine.
Campsites don't get out of control by themselves either, do they? You also mentioned that you were raising plants for Sunrise Meadows on Rainier.
We've been really lucky, and we've been able to help out Mount Rainier this year. Their greenhouse is out of commission temporarily, so this summer we grew 45,000 herbaceous plants for Sunrise Meadows at Mount Rainier, and we hope to do just as many for next year.
Wow. I've seen some pictures of some of the places where what you want is a meadow and what you have is patchy and kind of unworkable. So that is probably an area that gets almost more traffic than the Olympics because everybody wants to get to Rainier. So anyway,
yeah, absolutely.
You are still then working and planning and growing. And what I wondered, we're just getting to the end of this. I think we need another 4 hours. Are you still asking for volunteers at the greenhouse?
Yes, we always take volunteers at the greenhouse. We have open volunteer days on Monday and Wednesday from 9 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. And then we also have volunteer planting events and other things that come up that I announce through email.
Okay. So if people want to be on email to receive these, do they get it through Olympic National Park?
Yes. You can access the volunteer page on Olympic National Park website.
Okay.
Or people can email me directly if you'd like to.
That's Laurel Moulton at the Matt Albright Greenhouse.
It would be laurel_moulton@partner.nps.gov.
Okay. At some point, we'll get to the point where we can actually post these where people can read them. But as long as they know that you are working in revegetation for the parts of this world that have been drained and overused and all of that, it's really wonderful to hear from you. And I very much appreciate your time. I think we should do a whole other gathering on weeds and the problem of weed management in a national park.
That would be really a really interesting one.
It's very interesting, and don't we wish it weren't happening. So, Laurel, thank you so much.
And,
this is very much appreciated. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Back to our mystery sound. This is a ring-necked pheasant. These handsome birds were imported to the United States from Asia as game birds to be hunted. That was in the 19th century, when people didn't think about things so much. They are seldom seen on the Olympic Peninsula, but they definitely show up in bird listings. Look for them in open fields and field edges. Wendy Tweeten, thank you, Wendy, sent a photo taken last week of a pair, male and female, beside a road here. The male has vividly colored feathers with a green head, a red face, and the white banding around the neck that gives them their name. The female is soft brown and tan, colors that blend with autumn fields. They are far more common in the central United States, where they're often farm-raised and released as game birds. Events. Watch for rescheduling of events that were canceled during the storm. Some of those will come along this week.
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society has a meeting, Native Birds and Active Volcanoes Birding on the Big Island of Hawaii, October 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. And there's a field trip, the Nia Bay Pelagic, October 22nd from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Go to the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website for information.
Jefferson Land Trust would like some volunteers for a stewardship work party. This is two parts, and the second installment will be on November 5th, including something for everyone. The local youth environmental stewards, yes, are leading an innovative restoration planting project. Some of us will exercise basic carpentry skills, building large planter boxes to help get trees started above thick reed canary grass. This is on October 22nd, on Saturday. For more information, check the Land Trust site. Well, that's it for Nature Now this week. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is "The River Is Flowing," performed by Asher Quinn.
Mother Earth, carry me down to the sea. The river is flowing, flowing and growing. The river is flowing down to the sea. Mother Earth, carry me, your child. I will always be my.